Thank you for joining us for another ASTQB podcast. Today we're covering several subjects, and I'm joined by Judy McKay, president of ASTQB. And Judy's going to cover an exciting new announcement that has come out of ASTQB, as well as touching upon some really hot new trends and some exciting areas that we're touching upon in software quality. So, Judy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave.
So, Judy, let's start with that announcement from ASTQB. Can you give us some perspective on why it's so unique and it really is, it's really groundbreaking in many ways?
Well, what we've seen is a lot of people want to get an advanced level certification, but they're really afraid of the exam. And that's not warranted, but it's a very human fear, honestly, because you think, oh, gosh, I've got a 90-minute or 2-hour or even 3-hour exam, and oh, I don't want to take it, and I don't know if I know enough. And we see a lot of people just kind of backing off those advanced level certifications, mainly because of the exam. And let's face it, a lot of us haven't taken exams necessarily very recently. So I think there's a fair amount of trepidation there. So what the ASTQB has done is we're trying to take the fear out of exams, especially at the advanced level. So as of November 1st of 2018, we are going to offer a free retake if you by chance fail one of our advanced exams. So that takes a lot of the risk out of it, really. And I think what we'll see is people will go, you know, I don't have to be so tense. I don't have to be so worried about it. And you'll probably do better at it anyway, not being so worried. So a few parameters here. You do have to have your foundation level certification with the ASTQB. We do check that on advanced exams to make sure that you do have your foundation level, but it does have to be with us. You have to have taken a course with one of our accredited training providers. And we have a lot of faith in our training providers. We feel that if you've taken an advanced course from one of our training providers, you ought to do pretty well on that exam. And the obvious one, if you did happen to fail the exam, you have to have failed our exam. So those are the three parameters on it. But other than that, what we're trying to do is just take a lot of the fear out of this whole thing. Now, we do have a lot of confidence in our exams. We spend a lot of time building good exams and trying to make them as fair as possible. We use psychometrics to go over the questions, see if people are failing, you know, too many people are failing a particular question, or unfortunately, too many people are passing a question and it's too easy. So we work very hard to balance those exams to make sure that they are fair and that they are testing the knowledge that we're expecting to be tested. We watch for questionable questions. We edit, we re-edit. We have multiple people review every single question. And we also pass our questions through people that are actually not even testers to say, yeah, you know what, this worded confusingly. It doesn't make sense. Or, you know, you're not really asking a question, or, you know, it's an opinion. So we do a lot of extensive review, really, to make sure that those questions are high quality. And we also take our feedback very seriously. If we get feedback from people saying, ooh, wow, this question is wacko, you know, we jump right on that because, yeah, there's always a chance, right? There's always a chance. We actually had an interesting problem with our electronic test management. For a brief period of time, it got crossed up with a medical exam as well. So it had our questions and it had the medical exam answers. So, you know, you'd go through your testing question and go, yeah. And your answers were liver, spleen, pancreas, heart. So, you know, okay, in that case, yes, that was really not fair. But, you know, things do happen, right? So we look very seriously at any feedback we get.
Right. And I should note, speaking of feedback, I mean, the feedback that I've seen coming across is actually very positive. You know, sometimes I correspond with people who may not realize that there are different versions of the ISTQB exam. So each country board, for example, could have their own version. And there are even multiple English versions that are available out there. I had some feedback recently from a test manager who said, you know, I want my testers or people that I'm considering to hire having taken the ASTQB version of the ISTQB exam because it uses American English. I know it's well written. And if you can understand and follow and pass that exam, then I have great confidence that you actually understand English in a testing environment, and I'm comfortable hiring you.
And that's a really good point, Dave, because we do have our exams targeted at the American market. It's American English, it's American scenarios, it's things like that that we think are quite commonly encountered. Now, not that that doesn't apply on an international scale, it certainly does, but you know, if you're looking for something that's really going to ensure that people are understanding the right level of the English language, that they're able to interpret questions, but that the questions are also fair, that this is actually a good, basically, rating of their knowledge, then that's why our exams really, we feel, are the strongest in the industry.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of that as well, I have heard also good reviews on the fairness and just the understandability of the questions themselves. So no, that's great news. And so the whole idea of putting everyone at ease a little bit as they go in to take that advanced level exam, that's a kind of a one-time retake offer. So you get that second chance free. It ends at that point. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Because if you've tried it twice and you're not getting it, you probably need to go back and do more training, honestly. It's not just that you missed a couple of questions. It's that you might have missed some significant content, really, of what you needed to know. And one other point I wanted to make, too, is you know, taking the risk out of everything here. Some companies won't reimburse you unless you pass. And I had one of my own employees snuck off and took the advanced test analyst exam and then came back to be reimbursed. And the company said, well, you know, why didn't you tell us that you were going to take this? We could have registered it for you. And she said, because in case I failed, I didn't want anybody to know.
Mm.
So, you know, it's things like that, right? We just want to take that risk out of there. If you failed it, you don't get charged for it. You don't have to worry about your company saying, you know, we're not going to reimburse you. You know, it really takes a lot of the risk out.
Right. No, that sounds great. That sounds great. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the other subjects that you and I were discussing before the call here. And they both kind of touch upon automation, but let's hear what you have about both of them. It was very interesting.
So a couple points. I've recently been teaching the advanced test automation course, and a couple things keep coming up in the course. And one is, this has been around for a long time, but if you're going to do automation, if you've got an API to automate, go there. It's going to be faster. It's more efficient. You're less prone to issues that would occur if you change the user interface. If everything is communicated through an API, an application programming interface, then the UI can change all at once. It's still got to basically do the same things. Mm-hmm. So if you're testing at that API level, you're much, much less prone to have to make changes. Because let's face it, maintainability is the name of the game in automation. As soon as you're having to do too much maintenance, that's where all your money goes, honestly. It just goes right down the drain. So testing from the APIs, it's a lot easier to code it, honestly. You're basically just talking to the API. The API does X number of things. You code to each one of those things. And you're able to actually ensure that you have tested everything that API can do. You also can cover all the error conditions, and error conditions can be quite hard to introduce from the UI sometimes. And also from the back end, right? Where a database doesn't find the record or things like that. You're able to actually create all those error conditions when you're testing at that API level. You can do a wide range of data coverage with a limited amount of programming, again, using a data-driven kind of method where you can basically run the same script that's over and over and over again, and it's just basically pounding data through there and verifying that it's getting the right outputs. And the real good about this is there's excellent tool support for API testing. Hmm. You don't have to sit down and program that thing from scratch. You've got good tools, and you don't have to be a programmer to use them in a lot of cases. A lot of them are very straightforward. So the bads of automating from the API, it does require some programming knowledge, but it doesn't require hardcore programming.
Yeah, so this is not like advanced technical test analyst type of stuff. Can a test analyst handle this type of thing? And I'm talking about the ASTQB certifications.
Yeah, generally a test analyst or certainly an advanced test analyst should be able to do it, because the trick of API testing is actually knowing what needs to go in and out of that API. So this requires that domain knowledge, which is what you expect from your test analyst. Now, your advanced test test automation person, right, or your test engineer type, is maybe needed to do some of the programming aspects of it, but they're not going to know the domain as well. So really, in most of these cases, it's the test analyst that comes up with everything that needs to be done, and they may need a little bit of help with a little bit of the programming, and you're there.
That makes sense. Okay, great.
A couple considerations. You do have to have exposed APIs, which means that those are accessible by code. So generally, the code is running, especially like if you're doing like a web service, you're talking via APIs, but those APIs are not necessarily directly addressable. Mm-hmm. So they do have to be exposed by the developers, which is something your developers can do. You just have to be careful that if you expose APIs that are not intended to be exposed when you release to production, you do have a chance of exposing a security risk. Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind. And the other one is don't overtest. Don't test things that can't happen. Right. If you've got a user interface sitting in the front of it and it's going to make sure that it only gets valid data, well, then testing the API for all the invalid data might not make sense. Right. You're over testing in that case. Right. So just a little more of the how this works. So if you have like a SOAP based web interface, mm-hmm. You basically get the WSDL from your developers, which is the web service description language. And then you use a tool like SOAP UI, SOATest, those things. And they take the WSDL and sort out the inputs and the outputs, and you basically just fill them out, say, okay, well, this is the input, this is the output I'm expecting, and that's it. That's all the programming that's required, which is, okay, none. REST APIs also have whole suites of tools that can be used for automation. So we're not talking hard stuff here. We're talking, you need to understand basically how the code works. So this is where maybe, you know, more of the senior test analyst kind of person, the advanced test analyst type. Mm-hmm. But once you know that, very, very straightforward. Now, also in the world of Agile, these make a great basis for tests developers can run, right? We can hand this back to developers and say, hey, every time you do a build, if you're doing continuous integration, continuous deployment, hey, every time you do this, run these tests. I want to make sure you haven't broken the APIs. So great tools out there. You can also do performance and security testing at the API level, which is a nice thing. And the other thing I wanted to touch on is about service virtualization. So in the old days, you basically had to, if you had a service that didn't exist yet, but you had code that needed to talk to that service, you basically had to write what's called a stub. And the stub would just sit there and say, yep, I got your request and I'll send it back to you. So for example, if you were testing creating a user, but there's a subroutine that's called this test to see if the user already exists, and that service wasn't there yet, you would have to write a stub that would basically say, yep, that user doesn't exist, you're good. Okay, so that's what a stub does. Service virtualization has now come in, and again, the tools have really gotten good here. You basically sit the tool between the client and the service it would talk to. It records the traffic and it says, aha, now I understand the inputs and the outputs. Here we go. These are the ones we need to test. And it knows how to receive and how to reply the traffic to the traffic that it gets. And it basically builds itself. So you don't have to actually code the stub. The virtualized service builds itself with these tools.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
So sometimes these are called stubs on steroids. But it's basically, it depending on how complex your service is, this can be a huge help to have this thing actually build itself. It knows all of the traffic it can get. It knows all of the responses that it can get, and it basically can just build it. But what this gives us from an automation standpoint, so if you're an advanced test automation kind of person, it's reliable, it's consistent, and it's always going to do the same thing for you because it's basically another piece of code. And we can always extend it to add more features to it. So instead of saying, oh, I can't do my automation because I don't have – these services aren't available yet – you can. You can build them virtualized services, and then you're able to do that automation right from the beginning. As soon as you've got the thing that talks to the service that you don't have, you can build a virtualized service and get going on your automation. And that is the whole key of the game in Agile, is to get that automation done early and have it available for the entire project.
That sounds great. That's really good information.
And then the only other thing I wanted to talk about, because it's my new favorite toy, is robotic process automation. So what it is it's basically designed to automate repetitive processes and add some intelligent analysis as it does it, which is where the robotic part comes in here. And it's one of the ways that there's a bit of intelligent or artificial intelligence or machine learning, depending on which term you like better. But the idea here, it came about to remove manual errors and free humans to do more thought work and get rid of them having to do this repetitive stuff, like invoice processing, where it's basically the same tasks every time. But what it also has built into it is the ability to learn. So as it says, oh, well, this is a different kind of invoice. And then as it learns more things and it gets more data, it can start to make some of its own decisions. So that's the whole artificial intelligence aspect. But the cool things here from a testing standpoint, so people have brought this in to say, well, okay, it's faster than humans, it's more reliable than humans, because humans take breaks and stuff. But it also avoids having to take your big old invoice processing application and modifying it, which of course has the risk and inherent issues of introducing bugs. So rather than saying, hey, we're gonna modify our invoice processing to have some automation, it can say, you know what, just leave it as is. We'll sit this RPA tool on top of it, and it's going to actually be able to do the manual process that a human would have done, and it will also be able to learn as it goes. So you think, well, that's pretty cool. So easy to make changes if the process changed, because you don't actually have to go into much code. It's these tools are really high-end. Quoting Deloitte, Deloitte basically says an RPA is a combination of artificial intelligence and automation. So robotic process automation, which they refer to as a synonym to AI, is the application of technology allowing employees in a company to configure computer software or a robot, or sometimes just called bots, to reason, collect, and extract knowledge, recognize patterns, learn and adapt to new situations or environments. So a tremendous amount of capability in these tools, and they are, as you might have gathered, expensive. But okay, so why do we care, right? You go, I don't own this gigantic bank, and I'm not trying to do my invoice processing application, so why do I care? Ah, because these can be our friend if we want to do some automation. If we want to do some test automation, if you can automate the process, you can automate the testing of that process, right? So if you want to do some automation for things that would be normally like user acceptance testing, scenario based, the whole business driven, this is what people are actually going to do. Build acceptance tests, things that are scenario kinds of things. These are beautiful tools for this. You can also do some simple performance testing and say, you know what, this is what people do. They don't care about the time it takes for the screen to come up. They care what the time it takes end to end to actually process an invoice. So you can actually do some timing with these as well. The automation is built in little modules. So you basically have these little modules, and then you hook the modules together to make workflows. So modules are reusable. So as you can imagine, right, if you have to query on an invoice to pick the one that you're going to pay, that act to query on an invoice can be a module, and then I can use that module any place I want to in other workflows as well. So you get this huge reusability out of it for not a lot of effort, because they're quite easy to write and therefore they're quite easy to maintain. So very nice graphical interfaces on some of these tools, quite straightforward to use, but as I mentioned, they can be quite expensive. Because if you think about it, if they're selling these to big banks, that's where your big dollars come in.
Do you see them maybe becoming more accessible broadly in the future? Do you think that between demand or open source or some other approach?
I think with any tool, right, when it first comes out, it's really expensive, and then the market kind of drives it down, as you say, right, when you get open source. But one of the things that we found using it is, there are some tools that have free trials or community versions, where you can just get one, because these are meant to say, we're going to deploy, hundreds of these right across all of our applications. But if you think, I just really want a very simple build acceptance test. That's really what I want. I just want one of these, just one of these little bots that's going to run these tests every time. I don't need to run a mass. And that actually makes them affordable. So when you look at it that way, you can drop this price down to something that's a lot more compatible or comparable to, any of your regular automation tools. Now, they don't, they're not automation, test automation tools, right? They don't have, you know, some of the guts and the capability of some of the high-end tools. But if you're looking for something fairly simple and fairly fast and fairly maintainable, this might be a place to look. So a couple of pieces of advice here. Look for free trial or community versions. Make sure that you try it before you buy it. Make sure it'll work. But we were trying it on a Dynamics 365 application, which we had found, shall we say, difficult to automate and really difficult to maintain, and worked beautifully, which was impressive. Look for a drag and drop capability because it makes it so much easier to use, and the ability to record so that you're actually able to let it do some of the work as you're going along. You're going to have to, you know, obviously after you've recorded it, you're going to have to take it apart and make it more, you know, reusable code, but it saves you a lot of effort. And then you understand what it is thinking when it's looking at a UI. And then look at the pricing. Is it per bot or is it per server or is it per process? So if we're using it for automation, sometimes you only need one. So if it's just one bot, that's going to be your lowest price. So think about that with the pricing. The market leaders in this, according to the great god of the internet, Google, Blue Prism, UiPath, and Automation Anywhere are the current market leaders. So if you're interested in just taking a look at these tools and seeing what they can do, definitely worth taking a look. You know, a lot of this lets us kind of use our skills that we learn as an advanced test automator or advanced test analyst. Again, so these are kind of crossing between that, where you don't have to have a lot of hardcore programming capability, but you need to have good knowledge and good understanding of the business processes that you're trying to automate. So it's kind of that merging of the skills. And again, we find these tools to be really helpful in fast-moving environments, agile environments, iterative environments, where we really are seeing a lot of churn in the code and a lot of change. So their ability to be easily maintained and to easily adapt helps quite a bit. So definitely an exciting new area for automation. And stay current, though, because the tools change all the time. Capabilities. This is a relatively new market, so tools are going to be exploding in it, I suspect. And hopefully that'll also drive the cost down as well.
Yeah, no, that's really exciting. And the potential, the possibilities here are huge. But you're right, by the time we you know, hang up here, things will probably already started to have changed. So
so true.
You know, but I, you know, so that's why I really appreciate the fact that you can jump on. We can have this conversation. I hope we can have some additional conversations in the future. I hope that, you know, the ASTQB, you know, certified and faithful out there can join us again for another conversation with Judy, which maybe we'll call it that. But, we'll touch base if you're willing to do that.
That's great. Oh, thanks, Dave. I really appreciate the time.
All right. So I would invite the audience out there, if you have ideas, questions, or anything you'd like to hear on Conversations with Judy, if you will, please let us know. You can send them to info@astqb.org and look for future podcasts with ASTQB coming up.